From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The exchange of notes between the President and myself creates not only the necessary conditions for a speedy and successful settlement of the unsolved problems relating to the past, but what is much more important, opens a new page in the development of relations of real friendship and of peaceful collaboration between the largest republics in the world.
Well, it's been 85 years since the Soviet diplomat Maxim Litvinov, who we just heard, uttered those words after conversations with then U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, as Roosevelt decided to recognize the Soviet Union some 16 years after the Bolsheviks took power in November of 1917. Roosevelt faced a situation that seems remarkably similar to the one being faced by President Donald Trump, including massive institutional resistance to a change in the relationship between Washington and Moscow. Roosevelt named William Bullitt as ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1933 to 1936. Bullitt himself was openly hostile to the Soviet government and remained so for the rest of his life. He recorded these comments in 1952.
The communists are red fascists. Stalin will not stop of his own volition. He can only be stopped.
So today we're going to speak with our expert on this, our Soviet historian, Professor Luciana Bone. Luciana, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here. This is not the first American-Russian or American-Soviet summit, certainly. After the revolution in 1917, in the second revolution, the October Revolution, which, according to our calendar, took place in November, that was followed almost immediately by the United States withdrawing its recognition of the government that had been established earlier in February with Kerensky. The successor government was not recognized, and the Soviet Union was not recognized until Franklin Roosevelt, until 1933. So from 1917, it's about 16 years to 1933. And of course, the Soviet Union was becoming a formidable world power. They were building it from the ground up in industrial power. And the U.S. at some point had to acknowledge their role. So in a way, that was a coming-of-age recognition, a coming-of-age of a new set of power relations in the world where the Soviet Union had to be recognized as, a member of the, grown-up nations. And, that's kind of a parallel to where we are, recently also, as we've seen the monopolar moment from 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union sort of fading or transitioning into this multipolar world with China, not just rising, but pretty much risen, and a strategic partnership with Russia and, a whole lot of other stuff going on that tells us a new world is coming. Now, let's look at the history. So in 1917, you have first the February Revolution, then the October Revolution, and then the Soviet Union. You have the Bolsheviks in power, in essence. And this is the great nightmare of the ruling classes of Europe and America. And so there was a response to that. So let's start there, because we have covered this stuff, been pretty thoroughly over the last year.
Yeah, we did. We have covered the... As far as I can tell, the only country that recognized the Soviet Union was Germany, I think, in 1924.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Right.
So 1917 and the installment of the revolutionary Russia, which became the Soviet Union around the very early 20s, 22 maybe, was immediately encircled by 1919, was it 17 countries, including the United States, led by George, whatever his number is, of England, invaded the Russian revolution in Russian territory, and linked up with the anti-revolutionary called the Whites, and began a civil war, which devastated the country. So after that, of course, the revolutionary forces prevailed. Russia again was devastated. Industries, infrastructure, such as it were, there was railroads, were destroyed. In fact, the very basis, the social basis of revolutionary Russia was unemployed. That is, the proletarian class, which was 5% of the population, was unemployed. And so Lenin and his administration appealed to the peasantry. That is, we're going over stuff we've already
done.
That's
okay. That's all right.
But appealed, saw that the way out was, one, redressing the land distribution, which had been done in a hurry in 1917. Land was given to the peasants, but there were some very subjects who became very rich, who held land. And so, ironically, by the early 20s, after the Civil War ended, you actually had classes within the 80% peasantry. You had classes within that element.
Right.
You had the kulaks, very rich, who became the the ruling class, or rather the potent class.
Right.
After the other landlords of the Tsar time had fled. So what you had is a division of classes that had to be reconciled. That we go into the Stalin period. So you had to restructure the social base. You had to unite peasants to proletarians, but the proletarians didn't have jobs. Industry was on its feet. So when Stalin came in, he proceeded to implement Lenin's plan of rapid industrialization, or rather articulated Lenin's plan, that he saw that rapid industrialization was necessary in many ways also to mechanize agriculture so that it could produce food, but also income, because the army had to be fed. The army was 600,000, I think.
Yeah.
And it was, it needed everything. It needed equipment, it needed training, it needed schools, and the money to train the army, because Stalin knew that the West would be coming after the Soviet Union again, and the forces of fascism were rising in Europe, and Hitler came to power finally in 32, 33, but there had been many other fascist takeovers in Europe, including, of course,
Mussolini.
Italy.
Yeah.
So he knew that sooner or later, the armies of capital, maybe disguised as they were, as fascists, as Nazis, he knew they were coming.
Yep.
So the Soviet Union initiated the program of industrialization.
Right.
And that was an amazing feat in human history. And that put the Soviet Union, just as FDR was coming into power, began to put the Soviet Union on the same par as other, and then surpassed other industrial nations.
Right. So now they're a player. And then...
No, I know. So in FDR... He permitted Russian engineers and Russian technicians to come to the United States to observe the methods of production. And in fact, most of Soviet industry was arranged on the Ford method of production.
Right.
You know, so there was a great deal of cooperation between the Soviet Union and the United States at the time. And in fact, the Soviet Union annual growth, economic growth, was impressive. I don't remember what it was, was it 9%? And this is the period where the rest of the economies in the capitalist democratic world were zero. I mean, it was the Great Depression.
This was actually something that Roosevelt, you know, that was beating Roosevelt. You had American business was already starting to, you know, do some significant activity inside the Soviet Union. Ford Motor Company, for example, built a tractor factory. A lot of the transfer of technology that you referenced came initially through Ford. It was one of the major places. They're using that manufacturing process, which was an innovation at the time. And since you had the Depression here, they're looking for new markets, and this was a huge market compared to the markets that were available, you know, that people were about to go to war over around the world. Soviet Union was massive, and you could see that it was, you know, becoming an industrial force, and let's sell them stuff. And so Roosevelt had business people here, about half the business community, screaming for diplomatic recognition, and then there was another half, of course, that wanted nothing to do with them. That's also kind of similar to where we're at right now.
Well, so having given a bit of the background of the relationship between the United States historically in the beginning, the United States and the Soviet Union, when we said that they were cooperative relations. I mean, Stalin said, he knew, I can't think of the quote, but he knew Franklin Delano Roosevelt was an imperialist, and exactly that word, but he was a good man, someone he
I know.
Could trust.
I looked into his soul through his eyes, like George Bush with Putin, I know.
Yeah. But and so then we know, just to bring it up to today, that, of course, the Soviet Union and the United States were allies in World War II.
Right.
President Eisenhower, head of the forces in Europe, allied forces in Europe, and later president of the United States, had great respect, in particularly, and a good relationship, personal, with General Zhukov,
right,
who was the head of the Red Army, the Soviet Army, whom he admired tremendously, who either he said or somebody else said was the greatest general since Alexander the Great, continue his friendship with Zhukov into the 60s, before Eisenhower died.
Yeah.
And when Zhukov had a heart attack, Eisenhower sent him a very state-of-the-art latest model of a fishing rod because Zhukov liked to both fish and hunt.
Yeah.
So they were very close. Then in the 1960s, we have a whole story which there was a relaxation, so-called, but it's something that we still have to cover in our regular programs, you know, history of the Soviet Union. There was a relaxation, and we have a whole slew of summits, beginning with a disastrous one between President Kennedy and Khrushchev in Berlin.
Right.
And that was disastrous. Well, Kennedy admitted almost that he was roasted. He admitted to, in an interview, he roasted me or something, implying that he was too new for the job.
Yeah.
But there was the question of Berlin, of the division in Berlin, and then all kinds of spying activity, the U2, and the whole thing was a disaster. And then they came to blows over the, but finally, over the Cuban Missile Crisis, Khrushchev and Kennedy. But then, over resolving the crisis, they acted pretty well together.
Yeah.
And then we have...
You had some serious symmetry, too. You had the Test Ban Treaty. You know, there were some things that really came out of that after the... And it's kind of interesting because of the political dynamic that spun off of, you know, the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, you had a good week where people here were thinking World War III was going to start, like, today.
Absolutely.
And
right there,
psychiatric impact of that, I'm sure somebody has studied. But in political terms, you really have to, you know, guess that there was a constituency that developed to head off the possibility of nuclear war seriously after, you know, people living with the risk of it, like, imminently. For a week or so. And so Kennedy was able to seize on that, whatever that instinct was, and they made some progress. And from there, there was symmetry that went all the way through Nixon and beyond.
Yeah, 1972 was Richard Nixon and Brezhnev met in Moscow for their first summit, and it produced a historic arms treaty setting limits to the expanding nuclear arsenals of both powers. Then Nixon invited Brezhnev to Washington the following year, and the pair signed nuclear arms control treaties at three successive summits. In 1974, Gerald Ford met Brezhnev for the first time, and that was very funny, in Vladivostok, which was punishing cold, and Ford showed up with a wolf coat, you know, a wolf, what you call it, from Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And Brezhnev, there's a picture with him, with Brezhnev, with a cigarette in his mouth, hanging out his corner, putting on this furry thing, and they were joking and stuff. Uh-huh. And they discussed American football and joked. And then Ford, they met again in Helsinki, and that was the first of several U.S.-Russian summits that would take place in the Finnish capital.
Right.
And they met for the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And this discussions, in this meeting participated 35 nations. They signed the Helsinki Accords, a declaration which called for respect for human rights and for the inviolability of European borders,
right,
which really was the most significant moment of the Cold War. And when Ford came home, he faced criticism at home, and I don't think it was by the Democrats.
It was from Ronald Reagan.
Maybe. Was seen that he had made a compromise, a concessions to the Soviets, and had legitimized Soviet oppression of Eastern Europe. So Ford took that. How many summits were there between December 1987, when Reagan met Gorbachev, and they sign an accord banning intermediate-range nuclear missiles, which led to the destruction of 2,692 missiles by 1991. And then there were summit meetings between Gorbachev and Bush, HW, and Gorbachev completely cooperated on the Gulf War. I'm not proud of that. And so on and so forth. The summit meetings intensified during this critical period of turnover in Soviet Union from vaguely communist regime. It wasn't, but communist regime to so-called democracy. These What else? Oh, and Clinton met Russian leader Boris Yeltsin in Helsinki in March 1997 for talks. And they were viewed as some of the most crucial between the U.S. and Russia since the end of the Cold War, because at issue was NATO. Yeltsin, for the benefit of Russians, I suppose, complained a bit about the expansion of NATO to include former Soviet bloc nations, which had been promised to Gorbachev it would not happen. So it seems to me that American leaders used to act like statesmen. Yeah, they had their quirks, and that they could manage to do some progressive things for humanity in these summits, right, like arms control, etc.
Yeah, and you know, Ford is an interesting character because he's kind of a hack, like along the lines of Harry Truman, only not a boob like Harry Truman. He was also a master, like, congressional rat kind of guy. Like, he was, you know, Mr. House of Representatives for a really long time, and like, he knew that sewer inside out. And when he ended up as president, sort of in the, you know, accident of history
Watergate,
that happened,
in
Watergate.
I am not a crook moment.
Yeah, all of that, yeah. He ends up, and the pardon me moment, he ends up, you know, with the, you know, dynamics of these shifting relationships between the United States, Soviet Union, and China, with Kissinger... they're sort of implementing the real policy, you know, whoever was pulling his strings. He came from Rockefeller's, but whatever. The institutional power was still being expressed through Kissinger. They do Helsinki in 75. Ford comes home. It's going to be a 76 election. He's running for election, and because he was not really elected. He's getting primaried by Ronald Reagan, who's attacking him from the right. And then he said something in a debate: there's no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe and never will be under a Ford administration. And he was misspeaking, trying to defend Helsinki. And then you had Carter attacking it also, in apparently language from the left, but also from the right. And what actually happened was that Helsinki was used by all of the CIA assets and actual dissidents on the ground in Eastern Europe as an organizing tool. That Helsinki promised this, that, and the other thing. There were people inside each of the countries in the Warsaw Pact saying, they're not giving us this, that, and the other thing. It's a violation of Helsinki. And there was propaganda points that they were able to use and organizing words that they were able to use successfully.
Yeah. So I just wanted to interpose an anecdote about which meeting. It was a meeting in Washington between Ford and Brezhnev. When would that be? Let me see in my notes.
It'd be 75 or 76, I guess.
Yeah, which one was in, because this happened on the steps of the White House that I'm going to report on. In 2017, the Atlantic Monthly published an article by a member of Ford's entourage for the meeting. I think his name is Joad, J-O-A-D, and I can't tell you the title, but it will come maybe as I talk about it. Well, in 2017, right when the Russia stole the election hysteria began or was in full swing, this article appeared. And Joad said that, funny thing, he was at the dinner with Brezhnev, sitting close to him, And Brezhnev was smoking, chain smoking. He had an ashtray. And at a certain point, he took out a pill. And everybody knew that he was sick. He was a chain smoker, et cetera, et cetera. And he thought, if I could get that piece of paper, maybe we can find out what's wrong with him. So he kept an eye on this ashtray. The interpreter of Brezhnev, who was a super, probably the best ever interpreter in the world, whose name I can't remember, who had a tremendous memory, who took few notes. And by the way, interpreters are employees of the ministry, of the foreign ministry, and they rise in status. They can be called secretaries and can rise in status to advisors. This is, by the way, to advisors. And there, they could become ambassadors. This is how important interpreters are. So anyway, in comes the interpreter, the translator, who could do without any effort, from English to Russian and from Russian to English. And he comes in with a piece of paper and gives it to Brezhnev. Brezhnev reads it, nods, cuts it into little pieces and put it in the ashtray. Then Jode waits until the Russian delegation leaves. He pretends to be busy and he puts the ashtray in his pocket. Then he collates the pieces, and the pieces, says the Atlantic, the pieces, he could read Cyrillic. He got another friend and translated, and it's now in the Ford Library, this collage. And it verbatim repeated a conversation on the steps of the White House, I hope I'm not mistaken, on the location, where they were saying goodbye. This was a goodbye thing.
Yeah.
And Brezhnev turned to Gerald and said, to Ford, and said, you know, we support you. We will support your election all the way you can count on us.
Mm.
I mean, this is not a quote, okay? But that's the gist of it.
Right.
But if you read the Jode Atlantic article, it could be a pleasantry.
Yeah, it's actually Nixon and not Ford. It's in 1973. Yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm looking at the article. Yeah. Yep.
It's Ford.
June 18th, 1973. Nixon and Brezhnev with just translator Viktor Sukhodrev in the White House the day before the summit officially began. Nixon had his taping thing running, all of that. Even in big politics, this is Brezhnev. Even in big politics, the personal relationship between country leaders by far does not play a marginal role, but sometimes a really important one.
No. This is something else.
Oh, okay. Okay.
This is something else.
Go ahead.
We can talk to the listeners and quote it next time. This is not a transcript. This was not recorded, and
right.
Supposedly Brezhnev asked the interpreter, did anybody hear me? In other words, the Jode report, J-O-A-D, maybe I can find it. In just a second. So I think that the intention in 2017 in the Atlantic Monthly article, and it was explicit at the end, the author says, oh, I forgot all about it. You know, then when I retired, I said, what should I do with my papers? And they said, give it to the Gerald Ford Library. And so I did. And recently, 2017, I looked it up, and there it was, he says. I looked it up now in 2017 because all this Russia stole the election.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing, brought it to my mind. So even this little thing, you know, why should somebody produce this? It's a politicized article. We really need to ask why, what's going on.
So we'll pick it up there.
Okay.
Okay, Lucianna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.